I want you to picture a classroom from the year 2000. Just, you know, your standard elementary school room, maybe 25 or 30 kids.
Right, a typical setup.
Yeah. And statistically speaking, if you looked at the 8-year-olds in that era, the prevalence of autism spectrum disorder was 0.67%.
Which is incredibly low.
Exactly. So in a group of 100 kids, you might not even have one single child with a diagnosis. But now, fast forward to 2025.
It's a completely different picture.
It really is. That same hypothetical group of 108-year-olds, the prevalence skyrocketed to 3.2%.
That's a huge
It's
jump.
a staggering jump. Like, are we suddenly seeing more neurodivergent kids, or has the medical establishment finally just, you know, opened its eyes?
That is the big question.
Right. So today we're doing a deep dive into a massive 2026 report from AngelSense. It's titled, "The Increase in Autism and ADHD Diagnoses: What's Driving the Rise?" And our mission today is to figure out what's actually driving these numbers and how it impacts families.
And to understand a shift of this magnitude, we have to look at the mechanics of how society actually measures human behavior.
Right, because it's not simple.
No, not at all. We are looking at this really complex web of shifting psychiatric definitions, systemic changes in healthcare access, and even environmental biology. It's a fundamental rewiring of how we perceive the human brain.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because when you see a number jump from under 1% to over 3% in 25 years, I mean, the immediate human reaction is panic.
Of course, people assume there's an epidemic.
Yeah. The assumption is that something is deeply virally wrong. But before we get to the why, we need to clarify the what's.
That's crucial, yeah.
Because the source material is adamant that people fundamentally misunderstand the statistics being reported in the news.
They really do. The terminology gets conflated constantly. Like when the CDC talks about prevalence, they are measuring the total number of people in a population who currently have a condition.
So relative to everyone else.
Exactly. It is the absolute big picture. But the diagnosis rate, which epidemiologists call the incidence rate, is a measure of velocity.
Velocity. Okay, I like that.
Yeah, it measures the number of newly detected cases within a specific narrow window of time.
Meaning the prevalence is basically like a giant swimming pool of all existing cases, and the diagnosis rate is the hose pumping new water into it.
That is the perfect way to look at it. So when we say the prevalence for 8-year-olds hit 3.2% in 2025, that represents a diagnosis rate, the flow from the hose, that is 2.5% higher than it was a quarter century ago.
Wow.
And the surge is not isolated to autism either. The AngelSense report highlights that ADHD diagnoses hit 11.4% in a 2024 report.
11.4%.
Yes, and that was based on 2022 survey data. In raw human numbers, that is an increase of 1 million children just since 2016.
1 million more kids carrying a diagnosis in less than a decade. That's just wild. But what I find even more wild is who those kids actually are.
The demographic shift.
Yeah, the internal demographics of these numbers have completely flipped.
They have. And what's fascinating here is the story those demographics tell about systemic inequality.
Right.
Historically, if you look at the 2016 data, the highest rate of diagnosed ASD was in white, relatively wealthy communities.
Because they have the resources.
Exactly. But by 2022, that trend reversed entirely. The highest prevalence trends are now firmly in non-white communities.
Oh.
We are also seeing a stark gender divide. Boys are currently diagnosed at rates over 3 times higher than girls.
Okay, so whenever I hear statistics shifting that radically based on zip code or gender, I always find myself asking a fundamental question. Are we suddenly seeing more planes in the sky, or did we just build a much better radar system?
The radar didn't just get better, we entirely rewrote the manual on what a plane looks like.
I love that. How so?
Well, for decades, the psychiatric community relied on highly rigid, distinct categories. You had Kanner's syndrome, which represented profound, severe autism, often with significant intellectual disability. And then, completely separate from that, you had Asperger's, which was characterized by high verbal intelligence but severe social deficits.
Wait, so if a kid fell somewhere in the middle of those two extremes?
They fell into a diagnostic dead zone. They received no diagnosis and, consequently, zero specialized help.
That is heartbreaking.
It was. But the medical community eventually realized that human neurodevelopment isn't a series of distinct, unconnected boxes.
Right, it's a spectrum.
Exactly, it's highly fluid. So they widened the parameters, they folded all of these separate conditions under the broader autism spectrum disorder umbrella.
Making the net bigger.
Yes. Behaviors that were previously dismissed as a child just being, you know, quirky or difficult or having a vague learning delay, They were finally understood through the unified lens of neurodiversity.
And speaking of how the medical establishment views these conditions, there is a historical detail in this article that genuinely stopped me in my tracks.
Oh, the moral control definition.
Yes. It noted that in the early 20th century, ADHD was literally defined in medical literature as a defect of moral control.
It is a really dark reflection of where psychiatry used to be.
It's staggering. A defect of moral control.
Right. Rather than looking for a biological or developmental mechanism for impulse control or executive dysfunction, the medical establishment simply labeled it a character flaw.
Just the sheer arrogance required to look at a child whose brain is underproducing dopamine and label them morally defective.
It's deeply unfair.
You can imagine the thousands of kids who are sent to reform schools or heavily punished, all because doctors viewed neurodevelopmental differences as behavioral sins.
It was a very punitive era.
Which makes you realize that the surge in diagnoses isn't a tragedy, it's a triumph of empathy. Mm-hmm. Like, we are finally viewing this as a neurobiological reality rather than a personal failure.
It is a massive shift in empathy, and that shift is finally bearing fruit in our legislation, too.
Oh, right, the recent laws.
Yes, the source points to the Autism Cares Act of 2024. Prior to recent legislative purpose like this, autism just didn't have a comprehensive, dedicated federal framework for sustained funding.
That's crazy to think about.
It is, but the 2024 Act injected massive resources into community screening facilities and the training of developmental specialists.
Which perfectly explains that demographic flip you mentioned earlier. From wealthy white communities to non-white communities.
Exactly.
The rise in minority diagnoses isn't some subtle biological epidemic targeting specific racial groups. It's the result of federal funding finally building clinics in neighborhoods that private boutique medicine historically ignored.
The kids were always there, the specialists weren't.
Wow.
The historical bias was profound. A child in an underserved community presenting with ASD or ADHD symptoms was frequently mislabeled. They'd say the child had oppositional defiant disorder, or they were simply a behavioral problem for law enforcement to handle.
This is so grim.
But the funding changed the diagnostic lens, and we see a similar correction happening with the gender divide.
Right, because you said boys are still diagnosed 3 times more often than girls.
They are, but that gap is closing because we now know girls often present differently. They mask their symptoms.
Masking, like hiding it.
Yes. They internalize the stress, trying to socially conform rather than displaying the external disruptive behaviors typically seen in boys. Caregivers and teachers are finally learning to recognize that internalized presentation.
So expanding the umbrella, funding community clinics, and learning how symptoms present in girls and minorities. That better radar theory explains a vast majority of the statistical increase.
It explains a lot of it, yes.
But the article doesn't stop there. It explicitly mentions Robert F. Kennedy Jr. as a major proponent of this environmental theory. And as your hosts, we are neutrally reporting the contents of this article. We take absolutely no sides regarding RFK Jr. or the politics surrounding him.
We are simply conveying the environmental theory exactly as it is presented in the source material.
Exactly. Just looking at the scientific debate. So from that purely scientific perspective, what is the argument here?
The environmental debate posits that the actual baseline incidence rates of ASD and ADHD are legitimately rising due to external stressors.
Independent of our better radar.
Yes. Completely independent of improved diagnostic tools. The Angel Sense report outlines several specific factors researchers are currently investigating.
Like what?
Things like prenatal exposure to certain medications or endocrine disrupting chemicals.
Okay.
They're also looking at the biological impact of men and women having children at older ages.
Right, because the genetic material naturally accumulates more mutations as we age.
Precisely. They are even studying the impact of severe air pollution, specifically particulate matter that can cross the placental barrier.
And that causes issues with the brain.
The theory is it can induce systemic inflammation during fetal brain development. The scientific argument really hinges on epigenetics, the way environmental factors can essentially turn certain genes on or off without altering the underlying DNA sequence.
Oh, wow.
If a developing fetal brain is subjected to severe neurodevelopmental stressors, it could theoretically alter the trajectory of how those neural pathways form.
Leading to a higher baseline rate of neurodivergence in the population.
This raises an important question. How do you actually prove that?
Right. Testing that theory seems nearly impossible. It's like trying to figure out if it's raining harder or if someone just replaced your old weather gauge with a highly sensitive one that now counts the morning mist it used to completely ignore.
It is incredibly difficult. You cannot put human development in a vacuum. When your diagnostic criteria are expanding, societal stigma is dropping, and environmental pollutants are changing all at the exact same time.
It's all happening at once.
Yeah, isolating just the environmental variable is a monumental statistical challenge for researchers.
But here's the thing. Whether a child's brain developed differently because of an environmental trigger, or they just happen to be caught by a newly expanded diagnostic net, the reality on the ground is identical.
The diagnosis is the same?
Right. Millions of families are sitting in a neurologist's office hearing the letters ASD or ADHD. Here's where it gets really interesting, what happens the morning after you get that news.
The morning after is a profound turning point, because a diagnosis is a double-edged sword.
How so?
Well, it unlocks life-changing interventions, which is great, but it also forces the family into an incredibly hostile bureaucratic maze.
Oh, the paperwork and the systems.
Exactly. On the positive side, an early diagnosis is the golden ticket to specialized therapies. The article heavily emphasizes the critical window of neuroplasticity in early childhood.
And the data they cite on early intervention is mind-blowing. They break down a specific therapy called the Early Start Denver Model.
Yes, which is a form of applied behavior analysis. And it is vital to understand how that model works, because it's not sitting a toddler at a sterile desk and forcing them to memorize flashcards.
Right. It's not like old school drilling.
No, it is a naturalistic, play-based intervention. Therapists integrate themselves into the child's daily routines.
Like playing and eating.
Exactly. And they use the child's natural interests to gently build neural pathways for communication and social engagement.
And the results speak for themselves. The article notes this specific intervention can increase a child's IQ by an average of 18 points.
18 points.
That is massive.
Yeah.
Especially when you compare that to a mere 4-point increase for children who only receive standard conventional clinical therapy.
It's a game changer.
An 18-point jump is the difference between a life requiring constant 247 care and a life of relative independence and self-determination.
And beyond the clinical metrics, the diagnosis often brings a deep sense of identity.
Oh, especially for older kids and adults.
Absolutely. For someone who has spent their entire life feeling alien, you know, feeling like they are constantly failing to operate the machinery of a neurotypical world.
Receiving a diagnosis has to be an absolute revelation.
It really is. It provides a community and a vocabulary to finally understand their own mind.
But the article is brutally honest about the gauntlet that comes with that label.
The bureaucracy.
Yeah. Families immediately hit a wall of underfunded schools, confusing insurance mandates, and just intense societal stigma. And there's a real tension here. At what point does a label stop being a key that unlocks resources and start becoming a box we trap a kid inside?
That risk of overdiagnosis is a major theme in the current medical literature.
Because the umbrella is so wide now.
Yes. As the diagnostic criteria continue to expand, there is a legitimate concern that we are beginning to pathologize normal variations in human childhood behavior.
Like just being an energetic kid.
Right. If a child is simply highly energetic or slightly socially awkward, rushing to label them with ADHD or ASD might subject them to unnecessary medications or therapies.
Therapies that make them feel broken when they're actually just developing at their own pace.
Exactly. And compounding all of this is the fact that these conditions are rarely isolated.
Comorbidities.
Yes. The report notes that the co-occurrence rate of autism and ADHD is over 14%.
Wow. Over 14% of kids have both.
So you have a massive cohort of families trying to manage a child whose brain is simultaneously craving high stimulation dopamine hits because of ADHD.
While also experiencing severe sensory overwhelm because of ASD. That sounds exhausting.
It is incredibly challenging, which is why the AngelSense report transitions from sociological data into a highly practical roadmap for caregivers.
Because you can't just sit back and hope the system works.
No. Caregivers cannot afford to be passive participants in this system. The source breaks the necessary advocacy down into an aggressive before and after protocol.
Let's dig into that protocol, because the sheer volume of advice out there for parents is just paralyzing.
It really is.
For the before phase, the mandate is clear: do not wait and see. You track developmental milestones meticulously.
And if your child isn't hitting them, you seek an immediate evaluation from a neuropsychologist or a developmental pediatrician.
Right. And you don't just walk into that appointment blind. You have to act as the project manager of your child's brain.
I like that phrasing.
Yeah. You study the screening checklist, you organize the behavioral data, and you explicitly force the doctor to evaluate for comorbidities like that 14% overlap.
And once the diagnosis is secure, the after phase begins. This is where the real bureaucratic war is fought.
The insurance calls alone.
Caregivers have to navigate labyrinthine health insurance policies just to get therapies like the Denver model covered.
But the most intense battleground is usually the public school system, right?
Almost always.
The article talks about securing IEPs, individualized education programs, versus 504 plans. And this is a distinction a lot of people don't fully grasp until they are deep in the trenches.
It is a critical legal distinction. A 504 plan falls under civil rights law. It simply requires the school to provide accommodations so the child can access the learning environment.
Like what kind of accommodations?
That might mean letting them sit at the front of the class or giving them extra time on a test.
Okay, so it doesn't really cost the school much money.
Exactly. An IEP, however, falls under special education law. It is a legally binding document that requires the school to provide specialized, individualized instruction and services.
Which often means hiring aides or specific therapists.
Right. And because IEPs cost the district significant money, schools often push back hard against granting them.
Which is why the source is adamant parents have to fight for plans that address the child's specific needs, not just the diagnostic label.
You can't accept a one-size-fits-all approach.
No. If a school says, well, we have a standard classroom package for ASD kids, parents have to demand customization.
And this advocacy doesn't stop at the school doors. It extends right into the living room.
Creating a safe home environment.
Paramount. Many individuals with ASD have severe sensory processing differences. Caregivers are instructed to really audit their homes.
Limiting aggressive sensory inputs.
Yes. Humming fluorescent lights, strong chemical smells, chaotic background noise, all of these can trigger a nervous system meltdown.
But the most terrifying homefront issue the article addresses is the risk of elopement.
Wandering. Yes.
We are talking about children with ASD who will simply bolt. And it's not always because they are running away from something like loud noise.
Sometimes they are running toward something.
Right, like a fascination with bodies of water, completely oblivious to the mortal danger.
The mortality statistics surrounding elopement and drowning for children with autism are devastating.
I can't even imagine that fear as a parent.
It's a constant vigilance. But this is exactly where the assistive technology ecosystem has intervened. The report highlights devices like AngelSense.
The GPS trackers.
Yes, specialized GPS trackers and sensory-friendly monitoring wearables designed specifically for neurodivergent individuals.
Wait, but with all these bells and whistles hitting the market, aren't we just, you know, outsourcing empathy to an app?
How do you mean?
Well, it seems dangerously easy to slap a GPS tracker on a kid, look at a dot on a smartphone and say, problem solved, without actually engaging with the underlying reasons why they are overwhelmed or trying to escape in the first place.
Ah, I see. Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, the technology industry's entry into neurodiversity care comes with a strict ethical caveat.
Okay.
The source establishes a golden rule: technology must strictly augment, never replace, personalized human support.
Augment, not replace.
Right. A GPS device is a safety net. It can tell you where a child is, but it cannot comfort them. Mm. It cannot teach them emotional regulation, and it certainly cannot advocate for them in a school board meeting.
The human connection, the empathy, remains the irreplaceable core of the care model.
Always.
So what does this all mean for you listening? We started this deep dive looking at a completely transformed landscape, a statistical jump from 0.67% to 3.2% in just 25 years.
A massive societal shift.
Yeah. We've explored how the medical community finally realized the brain is a fluid spectrum, not a series of rigid boxes.
We saw how federal funding finally brought diagnostic equity to minority communities.
Right, and we navigated the complex debates over environmental biology. But mostly, we've seen what it takes for a family to actually survive the bureaucratic maze of IEPs, early interventions, and sensory management.
It is a profound evolution. Despite the massive systemic hurdles that still exist, the rising numbers ultimately represent society moving from a paradigm of isolation and institutionalization toward a paradigm of inclusion and early support.
We are seeing neurodivergence with clearer eyes than ever before.
We are.
And it leaves me thinking, if our medical understanding, our diagnostic radar, and our societal awareness of neurodiversity have changed this radically in just the last 25 years.
What will the next 25 look like?
Exactly. What will our schools, our workplaces, and our cities look like 25 years from now? For decades, society's default approach has been to force neurodivergent individuals into a neurotypical mold.
Asking them to mask their symptoms.
Yes. Tolerate the sensory overload, conform to systems that were never built for them. But what happens when we stop demanding? They adapt to us.
That is the real frontier. Maybe the next evolution isn't just about building better radar to spot the planes in the sky. Maybe it's about finally redesigning the airports so that all types of minds have a safe place to land.
I love that. Redesigning the airports.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Stay curious, keep questioning the numbers, and we'll catch you next time.